Welcome to another episode of On the Case, the LSE Law Society's podcast. I'm your host, Michelle. Now sit back and enjoy the show.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of LSE's On the Case. Today, I'm here with Ruth Chambers, who is a senior fellow at the Green Alliance, where she plays a leading role in maintaining environmental regulatory frameworks in UK law post-Brexit. And in addition to her Green Alliance role, Ruth is also an honorary professor of practice at the UCL Centre for Law and the Environment and an advisor to River Action UK. So thank you so much for joining us today, Ruth.
Thanks so much for having me. It's lovely to be here, and what a good time to be having this conversation.
So today we have three sections that our podcast is going to focus on. First of all, we're just going to sort of contextualize the environmental problem in the face of Brexit and the aftermath. And second of all, we're just going to delve a little more into your work in Green Alliance. And thirdly, we're just going to talk about maybe environmental policy and what it could look like in the future. So, Ruth, what made you choose to pursue a career in environmental law?
Well, I mean, I guess I've always loved, I've loved a few things that that come together in the work at Green Alliance. One is just nature and the natural world around us, and making sure that it's there for not only us to enjoy, but for those who come after us, future generations to enjoy. But it isn't just about protecting nature for nature's sake, because nature pretty much underpins all life on the planet and is also really important for, you know, society as a whole and the economy. So it's understanding that, and understanding that nature can't speak for itself and it needs laws and protections in order to thrive for the future. I've always been interested in the process of change and campaigning. So a lot of what I do at Green Alliance is trying to seek positive change through regulations and through the law. And I guess civil society in the UK is a place where you can bring those things together and you can pursue a career that not only hopefully has kind of benefits through through working on the law, but also allows you to reflect your own kind of personal interests. So that's kind of how I got into it. I mean, my degrees didn't necessarily suggest that was the direction I was going down. My first degree was in chemistry, which now seems a very long time ago, and I generally can't remember very much about the technical aspects of that. But actually having a science degree helps ground you in terms of thinking about things like evidence and discipline. So that's sort of partly the direction of travel that got me here.
Talking about your chemistry degree, would you say that you employ a lot of that as well as like a lot of legal aspects like on your job? Can you just tell us more about like kind of what you do on a day-to-day in Green Alliance?
I guess the first thing I should say is that no 2 days are ever the same. So, you know, there's an unpredictability because you never quite know what politics is going to throw up or what the government, you know, may be kind of planning either in the long term or the short term, or indeed what other plans, you know, colleagues in the sector sort of might have. So it's an unpredictable environment to work in, which makes it exciting and actually thrilling at times, but also quite challenging because sometimes best laid plans can, you know, quite literally go out of the window and all of that. So in order to operate in that kind of environment, then you need to be pretty reactive, so pretty responsive and fleet of foot and willing and able to change your plans, but also to respond to whatever the challenges of the day might be. But it's not just good enough to be reactive and to be, you know, following the agendas of others. It's also really important to think about what the right change is for nature protection. And in order to do that, that requires thinking about things in quite a structured way. So that's why things like, you know, project planning and science and law and evidence can really help, because then we can help direct our policy interventions to the places that matter the most, really.
Thank you so much. So speaking of these policy interventions, especially during very turbulent changes that are happening in terms of politics and in terms of our environment. So it seems like the UK's environmental policy is quite intrinsically tied with the EU and obviously has been impacted a lot by Brexit and these shifts in these frameworks. And so the EU is kind of generally known for setting these very strict standards and clear targets on environmental policy and requiring all of its member states to follow these regulations. So based on your observations and experience working in these sort of times, to what extent do you think these legislations were effective before Brexit? Otherwise, what were some noticeable flaws in the legislation that was apparent?
Yeah, I'm not too sure I can comment too much on what those kind of pre-Brexit flaws were, if you like, because that hasn't been a focus of my work. But what I can say is that Brexit, and this is an obvious point, has had a really kind of fundamental impact on the way in which we think about, formulate, and implement environmental law in the UK. So, you know, it's partly because before Brexit, you know, 80% of our, you know, environmental laws were formed at that EU level. So much of our legal framework was sort of, you know, was formed at that sort of supranational level. Not all of it, but a great majority of it. And over the last sort of 6 or 7 years, what we've really been focused on is that repackaging of that massive body of law, trying to ensure that we've got sound governance systems to watch over it and to make sure that it's not only formed with ambition, but where there are hiccups or where there are potential breaches, there are strong bodies to kind of intervene and oversee those. But also that sheer sort of disentanglement of, you know, when I say 80% of laws, it's thousands of laws that we're talking about. That isn't an easy process that, you know, the governments of the UK have had to grapple with. And inevitably, some things have, you know, been at risk of falling down the cracks. So that's also been part of the day job, is to monitor and police that sort of process, if you like, which has been complicated by the fact that environmental law and policy to a large degree is devolved across the UK. So it hasn't that process hasn't just been done once, it's been done kind of four times. You know, the UK government's obviously borne the brunt of that, but also within the other governments of the UK, they have been developing and passing laws and systems that in some cases resemble what the UK government has done, and in some cases look and feel quite different. So it's ended up being quite a messy and complex picture. I think we always knew it was going to be a bit like that. And that's definitely added to the challenge and added to, you know, to the day job. But ultimately, it's really important that we now embrace this greater proximity that we have with our environmental laws, because the EU's generally not involved in that process anymore. Obviously, it's very interested in it, but you know, our environmental laws are ours to make, ours to save, and ours to break, if you like. So we've got almost a greater responsibility than we had before.
So, elaborating on this, in one of your articles, you were talking about seabird conservation laws, and you identified this sort of growing gap between UK and an EU environmental policy post-Brexit. So, do you mind elaborating on sort of this and contextualizing it within the problem?
Yeah, so with Brexit came a sort of a freedom, if you like, to not necessarily follow what the EU or indeed any other kind of set of nations were doing. And that was one of the driving forces for Brexit, wasn't it? That kind of quest for homegrown lawmaking responsibility, or one might call it a greater sense of sovereignty. And if you take a look at our environmental law landscape through that lens, then it's quite a sort of messy picture, because what happened in the course of Brexit is that most environmental laws that came from the EU were brought across into our statute book through a process of transposition. So most were kind of faithfully, or at least as faithfully as they could be, replicated. But because some of those laws pointed to EU institutions, then they couldn't be absolutely replicated. So, you know, so some kind of changes had to be made. And then there were the sort of the recreation of, you know, the systems that we used to have to oversee those laws, so things like the role that the Commission and the courts would play. So to give you an example of that, you know, the Commission and the courts don't play that overseeing role in the way that they used to. Instead, we've got domestic institutions that have either been developed or are on the way. So in England and Northern Ireland, a body called the Office for Environmental Protection has now been established to hold the government and to hold public authorities to account. In Scotland, that role is done by Environmental Standards Scotland. And in Wales, there isn't a formal permanent statutory body, but one is on the way, and the Welsh Government has pledged to bring legislation to do that into the Senedd in Wales later this year. So that's been one part of an evolving and quite complicated jigsaw. But in terms of some of the areas where, if we can call it divergence, or in some cases regression has come, then chemicals might be a good example, because we've established a new version of a system called EU REACH, which is the process by which EU nations regulate and govern how chemicals are used and regulated. So we've recreated that in the UK through our own kind of system. But of course, we haven't got the same level of resource to manage that system. And what's happened almost by default is that the UK is falling behind some of the restrictions that the EU is doing. And this is causing a lot of consternation. So the government in the UK is preparing a new environmental improvement plan. So this is its plan for how it's going to meet different targets and different goals. And chemicals is a part of that. And the new plan is expected later this summer. And I think all eyes will be on that plan, really, to see how the government is going to cope with these kind of challenges of regression. And the simplest thing in this particular case would be for the UK government to say, well, this is very difficult. We haven't got the resources to do everything we'd like. So what we will do is commit to match or indeed exceed EU protections in the chemical space. And that's something that we think should happen, for example.
Okay, thank you so much. So moving on to section two, just now you mentioned a lot of like specific focus areas. So for example, the complications with devolved legislature and also chemical regulations. So contextualizing this to your work in Green Alliance specifically, would you say they were the sort of main focus areas of your campaign? Are there any specific areas that you kind of worked on during the aftermath of Brexit, given this gap?
Yeah, so I think as we've talked about, that transfer of those thousands of environmental laws was definitely a big focus for us. Another focus was making sure that each of the four nations in the UK had an effective replacement governance system, and each country is doing it a little bit differently. But in essence, most countries have a system that has three or four legal cornerstones to it. So I've mentioned those environmental governance bodies that will hold the governments and public authorities to account. That's one of those three or four sort of foundations. Another is legally binding targets, which has happened in England. Earlier this week, the Scottish Government published a nature restoration bill, and that includes proposals for nature recovery targets in Scotland. So that would be a new development, very exciting potentially. In Wales, as I say, we've got legislation coming into the Senedd later this summer, and hopefully that will do something similar for nature targets. And in Northern Ireland, I think it's fair to say the case is still being made. So that's another leg or another foundation of our kind of system that we've been actively trying to get on the statute book. Another one is something that we call environmental principles. So there are four core EU environmental principles. So things like the principle that the polluter must pay, or the precautionary principle, for example. And again, each of the nations has been embedding those systems in our domestic frameworks in a slightly different way, but broadly in the same way. So there's a requirement on each government to take those principles into account when it makes policy. And then the final part of the kind of system is a plan or a set of actions for how the government is practically going to improve the environment. It's called something different in each country, but more or less there is a version of that. So that's just the governance framework. And already you can see, each kind of arm or leg of that is quite a significant piece of work. So a big focus for us has been making sure that those systems are in place. But the work doesn't stop there, because once the systems are in place, well, we don't just want them to be paper systems. We want them to be used. We want them to be respected by governments. And we want us as citizens to be making the most of those tools that we've been given. And an example of how we can all do that is any one of us in England, for example, if we feel that a public authority is not respecting an environmental law, we can make a complaint to this governance body, the Office for Environmental Protection, and ask it to investigate. Now, the OEP doesn't have to investigate, it's got a limited amount of resource, but several complaints from the public have been picked up and have led to enforcement action against the government or against public authorities. So it's something that we're keen to raise a bit of awareness about, because it is a really important right that we had when we were a member of the EU and we started still have that right today. So that's another example. And then the other part of the day job, I guess, is now that the governments are free to legislate in their own way and to meet their own kind of chosen objectives, that's what they're doing. So in each parliamentary session, in each parliament of the UK, we are seeing new and slightly different environmental legislation coming forward, for example, and making sure that that is as ambitious as it might be, but also that the other legislation that governments want to do, and thinking in particular of the UK government's planning reforms that are, coming later this year, for example, making sure that that is all compatible and that respects those environmental principles, then that's also part of what we've been doing.
So, thank you. So, just now you mentioned the idea of enforcing these environmental policy frameworks, and one way you could do this is through complaining through government bodies. So, would you say that this has been an effective process? Because a lot of criticism for these government bodies is that they're often bureaucratic or they're unresponsive to these kinds of complaints. So, would you mind elaborating on specific examples or just what you think about that?
Yeah, the opportunity to make a complaint that I'm talking about is really to complain directly to the Office for Environmental Protection. So if you feel that, either the Environment Department or a body such as Natural England or the Environment Agency is not fulfilling its legal responsibilities, that's something that you can do. So to give a couple of examples of where I think this has been effective, I mentioned earlier that the government has an obligation now to set legally binding nature restoration targets and legally binding targets to clean up our air and water quality. So that was an obligation that was introduced by a piece of legislation that we worked on called the Environment Act 2021 that gave the government, the UK government, this duty, and it also specified a date by which this duty should have been met. The UK government missed that date for various reasons. So, as soon as it did that, it was not complying with an environmental law. So, we went straight to the government because that's the process. You have to go to the public authority first and said, "We're sorry, but you've missed this date. Please, what are you going to do about it?" And the way in which the government's complaint system works is that you have, I think it's 20 working days that they have to respond. Within those 20 working days, that target's deadline had still been missed. So we went to the OEP and said, "Well, look, we're really concerned that the government's not meeting this legal deadline. Nature is in a terrible state of decline. These targets do need to be expedited and brought forward as quickly as possible." So the OEP picked up that complaint and it wrote to the government and said, "Look, we want these targets to be in place as quickly as possible." And that worked, and that helped. That was an extra kind of factor in persuading the government not to drag its heels, but to bring these targets into being as quickly as possible. So that's one example. A more technical, but maybe a sort of more live example is in relation to a toxic bee-killing pesticide called neonicotinoids. And for a few years, the previous government had granted emergency authorizations for the use of these pesticides in relation to spraying of sugar beet crops, generally in the east of England. An organisation, a charity called Client Earth, looked at the way in which those authorisations had been made, smelt an environmental rat, for want of a better phrase, and made a complaint to the OEP that said, "Well, we don't think this process has followed environmental law, and in particular, how can it have had regard to the precautionary principle when bodies like the Health and Safety Executive and even the government's own impact assessment are pointing to this very serious impact on bees, for example." And the OEP also picked up that complaint, is looking into those historical processes. But this time round, the new government actually refused that authorisation. So it's hard to say how those processes were linked together, but certainly that complaint and the OEP's investigation have really shone a light on exactly how the government was making those decisions and how environmental principles were being taken account of.
Okay, thank you so much. So, here we're talking about the UK government kind of not following through on its deadlines and its environmental targets, mostly because it has the ability to sort of depart from these EU bodies. And so, circling back to the article that you wrote about seabird conservation, I remember you identified a specific case where the EU actually challenged an environmentally progressive piece of UK legislation, despite many instances of the opposite happening. So, can you elaborate on this specific case for any of our listeners?
There's a great irony to this case. I'm really glad that you've brought it up because, exactly as you say, if we had been trying to predict an issue on which the UK and the EU would have, fallen into major conflict, we perhaps would have suggested that it would have been an area where the EU was picking up the UK for its kind of its regression. But it is the opposite, as you say. And it's a case involving the UK and the Scottish government's decision to close fisheries in the North Sea and in Scottish waters for sand eel fishing. And what are sand eels? Well, they are small organisms that that live in those seas that are a really important foodstuff for endangered seabirds like puffins. So the conservation community really welcomed this decision by the UK and the Scottish government. It's been a really long time in the making. This is a long campaign for organisations like the RSPB, for example. So we were really delighted when the two governments decided to close those fisheries. However, some of the EU nations were less delighted because they'd been fishing these same sand eels for different uses, so for kind of industrial uses, especially in Denmark, I think. So they challenged the UK and the Scottish government's decision. And the way in which they challenged it was one of the sort of processes or one of the products of Brexit was something called a trade and cooperation agreement between the EU and the UK, which sets out various rules and stipulations about how the two bodies will work together, including on environmental cooperation. And it also provides for a process of dispute resolution, what to do when the two, the UK and the EU can't agree. And it's this process, this dispute process, that's been tested in relation to sand eels. And actually, a few weeks ago, a court called the Permanent Court of Arbitration, which is based in The Hague, it had some independent judges that were appointed to decide the outcome of this particular case. And I think we're now waiting for the result for those judges to produce their judgment. And this will be really important because it will obviously decide what's going to happen in relation to the sand eels and therefore the puffins and other seabirds in the North Sea. But it also will perhaps sound quite an important call to the EU should it want to kind of challenge the UK's progressive environmental policy again. So it's seen as quite an important test case of this trade and cooperation agreement. And I think we should get the judgment later this spring. So keep your eyes out for that one.
So thank you so much. And departing from your sort of work in Green Alliance, you also mentioned that you were involved in advising other campaigns. So for example, River Action UK. So would you mind elaborating on that to our listeners as well?
Sure. So my permanent day job is with Green Alliance, which is an environmental charity and think tank. But like other people in the sector, then sometimes we have the opportunity to use our skills to advise other organisations in a voluntary capacity. So that's what I do with River Action. I'm on an advisory board along with other environment sector professionals and other colleagues. And River Action is a relatively new kid on the block, actually. It was formed, I forget how long ago, but sort of within the last 5 years or that kind of time frame. And it's a really exciting campaign, which I'm delighted to play a really small part in. And it was, I suppose it was sparked by the desperate plight of our waterways and our rivers, which, are polluted within an inch of their life and in some cases beyond that. So River Action exists to end that water pollution crisis facing our rivers, our lakes, and other water bodies. And it's an audacious campaigning organisation, which I think is definitely needed in this space. And how I help is, as I say, I play a very small part in supporting the excellent staff team at River Action in just being a bit of a sounding board for some of their campaign ideas, and we get together every couple of months and just play some support on that. If you want to have a look at their website, that gives you all of the updates on what their current and upcoming campaigns are. But as I say, they're a really exciting campaign body, and they are certainly pushing some of the legal boundaries in terms of seeking legal action through some of their work as well.
So speaking of, campaigns and playing this sort of advisory role to these much needed solutions to these very urgent problems, I'm going to pivot to section three, and we're going to talk about, potential solutions or what the future holds for environmental policy in the UK. So what work do you think at the moment kind of needs to be done in terms of policy making, regulations, and laws to just ensure better environmental protection in the meantime without the EU as this main regulatory body?
So it's a great question. I think the first thing I'd say is we have a lot of environmental laws and a lot of environmental policy. A natural or an obvious starting point would be to use those laws and policy. We have a lot. We should make use of what we have. We have an Environment Act that was passed in 2021, which was very extensive, that covered air quality, water quality, biodiversity, resources and waste, and so forth. So it doesn't mean that our environmental law toolkit is complete, but we have a lot and we should get on with using that. Secondly, is resourcing. So at the moment, the government is undertaking a spending review, which will allocate resources to different government departments and different activities. So if the government is serious in its ambition to halt nature's decline and to be the most nature-positive government ever, it will need to put its money where its mouth is. So when that spending review is concluded, we will need to see adequate resourcing put into not just DEFRA, the environmental department, but also other cross-government initiatives, for example. And thirdly, I think, the environment is a very important thing for people, and remembering that and involving the public and civil society organizations in how these future policies are made, will be something that, the government should think about doing too.
Thank you so much for that very eloquent response. So, in terms of public involvement, we have a lot of, for example, law students or like environmental enthusiasts who are like listening to this podcast right now who might be looking to get more involved in this area of law and campaigning. So, do you have any good tips or words of advice for people who kind of want to get involved?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's not a crowded space, the environment sector. It's certainly a lot bigger and diverse in terms of the types of roles that exist than perhaps it was when I started my career. So, a good first thing would be to scout the landscape and to have a look at the sorts of jobs that exist out there. And environmental law professionals are really sought after, not just by, law firms or by the government legal service, but also by environmental organisations. Some of the bigger NGOs, for example, have in-house lawyers, some have a legal internship scheme, but actually environmental lawyers can find themselves in all different, facets of organizations too. So have a look at the landscape and see if there are particular roles that might appeal to you, and then what sort of, what journey you might need to take to get yourselves a little bit closer to those roles. Lots of organizations, exist, and can't exist rather without volunteering. So there are different ways that you can volunteer. Groups like the Wildlife Trust, offer lots of different schemes to help them practically manage their nature reserves or practically engage with local people or local school children. So check out their sort of Wildlife Trust websites if you want to get your hands dirty and, get more kind of on the ground experience. But also places like LinkedIn, if you have a LinkedIn profile, then you can start to explore that. Is probably the best social media platform for environmental law. There are lots of environmental lawyers talking about what they're doing, talking about different developments or progressions or threats to environmental law. So it's a place where you can find out what's going on and tap into lots of networks and groups. But you can also start to develop your own voice in that space. And if there are things that you want to comment on, then you can do that, as well through those kind of profiles. So there's plenty of other things as well, but those are perhaps some things that your listeners could think about doing. And never be afraid to reach out to people who you think, well, gosh, that looks an interesting role. Could you tell me more about that? Or could you tell me how you got into that particular role? And generally, I find that when people ask those questions, then colleagues are usually more than happy to answer and have those sorts of conversations.
So thank you so much for also answering all of my questions about the environmental law, and for participating in this podcast. I think a lot of your answers were really helpful in illustrating the importance of this issue and kind of what people can get involved in the future. So I just want to thank you so much for your time. I had a great time recording.
I had a great time being recorded. So thanks for asking again, and best of luck, with everything you're doing. Thank you.